The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. My name is Jenna Walker for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Money.com, Barron's, and hopefully The Economist. So let's begin with a Money.com article. It's the four best money moves for June from the June 1st, 2020 magazine. Adam Hardy is the author. Warmer days are here. School is coming to an end. Hopefully vacation or two is on the horizon. There's certainly a spirit of relaxation in the air with the start of summer, which makes it easy to mentally check out of your finances. Just don't let your post-Memorial Day malaise turn into an all-summer long financial autopilot. Some prudence now can keep the scorching summer months from burning a hole in your budget. For the month installment of Money Moves, we'll detail the money-saving magic of off-peak summer travel, what the Federal Reserve has to do with your savings account, an upcoming financial aid deadline for college students, and how to prepare your finances for a rough hurricane season. Here's how to get your summer off to the right footing. 1. Try to travel off-peak this summer. If Memorial Day weekend is any indication, summer travel this year could be returning to pre-pandemic levels, according to the Auto Club, AAA. The thing is, with inflated prices for gas and airfare, the price tag on your summer getaway might come with a heavy dose of sticker shock. As Money senior writer Sarah Hansen details, traveling off-peak times is one of the several ways to save money during an inflation-marred summer. For example, people save an average of $75 booking domestic flights on Tuesday or Wednesdays instead of on weekends. Hansen reports, larger seasonal trends come into play as well. You can score additional savings by scheduling your vacation for later in August, September, or October. With gas prices at record highs, those who are hitting the road should mind where they fill up. Due to tax and cost differences, gas prices can range dramatically, state to state, and even county to county. For example, heading north on Interstate 55, you'll find the average gas price in Missouri hovering around $4.25, according to AAA. Crossing into a neighboring Illinois, the average price jumps up to $5.13. Because demand is picking up, AAA says you should start booking your travel sooner rather than later. Finding any last-minute deals is unlikely. If you need... Shopping around for a new savings account. We probably don't need to tell you this, but interest rates on so-called high-yield savings accounts lately have been laughable. According to the FDIC, the national average interest rates for savings accounts is 0.07%. Thankfully, that's starting to change. The annual percentage yields, APY, are on the rise. Why? The Federal Reserve, a.k.a. the U.S. Central Bank, is hiking interest rates to tame inflation. Federal Reserve policymakers have already hiked rates twice this year, and they're expected to rise interest rates again this month. Before your eyes fully glaze over, let me just say this higher-level jargon-laden monetary policy can have a real impact on your wallet. Here's the short of it. When the Fed raises interest rates, borrowing from banks typically gets more expensive for the consumer. Interest rates on savings accounts, on the other hand, eventually start to get more attractive. While banks are quick to hype up interest rates on new loans and mortgages, they usually drag their feet with the increase in the APY. So don't expect the yield on your savings account to shoot up overnight. Some banks, however, are quicker than others. Online bank Ally, for instance, just raised the rates for its high-yield savings account to 0.75% at the end of May. With another Fed rate hike anticipated later this month, APY of several banks will be following suit. Number three, fill out your FAFSA to receive any remaining funds. If you enrolled in college during 2021 to 2022 session, school year, and never filled out this year's FAFSA, June is the last month to do so. The free application for federal student aid is a form the federal government, states, and individual colleges use to allocate billions of dollars of need-based and merit-based aid. While state and college scholarships are largely finished for the 2021-2022 academic year, you can still get federal student loans and need-based Pell Grants, even for classes you've already completed. Each year, the FAFSA opens on October 1st for the next academic year. And while you should strive to fill it out ASAP because some funds is first come, first serve, life happens. The good news is that you have until June 30th of the year you enrolled to complete it. In other words, for 2021-2022 academic year that's coming to an end, the application opened on October 1st, 2020. And it closes on June 30th this year. Experts recommend that you fill it out annually, even if you don't think you qualify for aid. If you forget to complete the FAFSA for the current academic year and are taking more classes in the fall, chances are high that you haven't filled out the 2022-2023 FAFSA either. And while the financial information is fresh in your mind, you should consider knocking that one out too, if you haven't already. And number four for this money article is brace for rough hurricane season. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, the hurricane season is going to be another doozy. The Atlantic hurricane season officially starts June 1st, and NOAA predicts as many as 21 named storms, including up to 6 major hurricanes with winds of at least 111 miles per hour. The agency says this season marks the 7th above-average hurricane season in a row. If you live in a state near the Atlantic Ocean or the Gulf of Mexico, this isn't great news. Many folks are still recovering from last year's Hurricane Ida, even 2017's Hurricane Irma. That's not to say you shouldn't be panicking, but rather planning. First things first, you should make a hurricane preparedness kit. This includes cash, water, non-perishable foods, flashlight, and blankets. In addition, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommends that you compile a first aid kit. This packet, there's a link in the article, this packet should include important financial and legal documents of everyone in your household, such as multiple copies of IDs, birth certificates, and Social Security cards. You'll also want to compile a contact information for various insurance companies, homeowners insurance, flood insurance, private mortgage insurance, and health insurance, to name a few. What you would need to contact if you or your family member was hurt or if your property was damaged. Ideally, your documents should be stored in a waterproof container. If you're just getting started, all this may sound slightly overwhelming, but the emergency kit becomes easier to maintain over the years once you have the base kit set. You can also go to ready.gov. They also have tons of resources and worksheets to help you prepare and get your documents in order. Okay, for our next article, Barron's, Bernanke, why the Fed didn't act faster to rein in inflation. The Federal Chair Reserve, Jerome Powell, has a new term in office, but no time for a victory lap. The highly unusual recovery from the pandemic recession, including a sharp increase in inflation, has raised the question of whether the Fed's new monetary policy framework is right for the times. Powell announced a new framework called the Flexible Average Inflation Targeting, or FAIT, F-A-I-T, in August 2020. The new framework kept the Fed's 2% inflation target, but made two key changes. First, the Federal Open Market Committee agreed to try to make up for past undershots, though not overshoot, and the inflation target. If inflation had been below 2% for a while, as had been the case for much of the past decade, the FOMC would compensate by allowing inflation to run moderately above 2% for some time. The goal was to demonstrate that the target was truly symmetric, with no tendency for inflation to remain either below or above the target for long periods. In contrast, under the traditional approach, policymakers ignored the size and duration of past misses and simply tried to reach the target over time, letting bygones be bygones. Second, the FOMC would no longer, as it had at times in the past, try to forestall possible inflation pressures by tightening policy in response to improving labor market conditions, even in the absence of actual increase in inflation. In the new framework, the FOMC forswore such preemptive strikes on inflation. Instead, to avoid inadvertently snuffing out nascent job market recoveries, it said that an improving labor market would not in itself be sufficient reason to tighten so long as inflation seemed controlled. However, last year and this year, too high rather than too low inflation became FOMC's main problem. Some influential economists, including former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, Oliver Blanchard, former chief economist of the International Money Fund, and Jason Furmer, the former top advisor to President Obama, were early in voicing concerns that powerful fiscal stimulus and easy monetary policy would overheat the economy, leading either to a 1970s-style inflation or a hasty tightening by the Fed that would disrupt the economy and markets. Inflation did pick up much faster than the Fed policymakers had expected. By March 2022, the 12-month increase in the prices of personal consumption expenditures, including volatile food and energy categories, reached 5.2%, well above the Fed's target, as measured by better-known consumer price index, including food and energy prices. Inflation that month reached a shocking 40-year high of 8.6%. How did this happen? Over the course of last year, the FOMC had become increasingly worried about inflation, but policymakers did not announce an end to their securities purchase program until November, and the first rate hike of a quarter point did not come until March. In May, FOMC raised its policy rate an additional 0.5% point, and the announcement with a plan to reduce the size of its security holdings. With the Fed now focused on inflation, a serious tightening campaign is underway. But in retrospect, at least some Fed policymakers and many outside economists agree the early action against inflation would have been desirable. Was the new FIAT framework responsible for the delay in acting? On the margin, FAIT put more emphasis on achieving a strong labor market, which the FOMC had correctly characterized as providing broad-based and inclusive benefits. It thus may have made policymakers a little more patient about responding to the first signs of inflation. However, the more important reason the FOMC did not act early was not the policy framework, but the unusual effects of the pandemic, which made the situation more difficult to diagnose. The pandemic scrambled usually reliable indicators of labor market strength in mid-2021. Fed policymakers saw the economy as still far from full employment. The unemployment rate in June was 5.9%, well above the pandemic rate of 3.5%, and millions fewer people held jobs. However, in pandemic economy, these indicators disguise the labor market's true strength. Many people had to put off returning to work because they needed to take care of family members, were concerned about getting sick, or rethinking life priorities, as is now evident in sharply rising wages and the difficulty of employers in finding workers. The labor market over the past year has been more robust than conventional measures suggest. In addition, the FOMC also saw an uptick in inflation in the middle of 2021. The inflation ex food and energy prices was running at about 3.5% over the summer, as largely reflecting temporary forces related to the reopening of the recovery. These included the reversal of price declines in sectors hit hard during the pandemic, hotels, airfares, supply chain bottlenecks, and a sharp shift in consumer spending away from services that led to higher prices for vehicles, appliances, and other durable goods. These supply-side shocks, including the disruption to labor supply, seemed likely to ease as the virus came under control, supporting the Fed's view that the inflation surge was likely to be temporary. Inflation expectation, as measured by surveys of households and businesses and the yields on inflation-index government bonds, generally remain moderate despite the pickup in these prices. The pandemic supply shock was indeed an important source of inflation, but it would prove larger and more enduring than the FOMC expected. Further increases in energy and food prices associated with the war in Ukraine added to price pressures, inflation. Expectations over a medium term and the next 2 to 3 years have still not risen much, showing public confidence in the Fed's resolve. But high inflation has persisted and spread to more sectors of the economy. The Fed's challenge is now to bring down inflation without inducing a recession, a soft landing. If the Fed delays in tightening is explained mostly by the unusual circumstances of the pandemic, rather than by the fiat framework itself, what does it imply for the framework when the next review of 2024-2025? I expect relatively moderate changes. If inflation falls back to pre-pandemic levels and too low inflation reemerges as a potential problem, then overshooting aspects of the fiat will still be useful. If inflation does not fall to earlier levels, then the overshooting will never or rarely be necessary. But neither will be provisions cause problems, so it will likely be retained. Just in case it is needed in the future, a bigger problem is the difficulty the FOMC has had in determining when the recovery is at full employment. A revised framework should more explicitly acknowledge the difficulty not only of forecasting full employment, but of identifying when it occurs. By doing so, the FOMC can retain its commitment to a strong labor market, but also give itself more flexibility to respond promptly when inflation's when needed. Okay, this is from Barron's, Retirement Streetwise. The author is Jack Huff. It's Off Target, How a Popular Strategy is Coming Up Short. I'll turn 50 this year, and I'm being honored with a catch-up contribution and a colonoscopy. Although technically a task force of doctors just lowered the recommended age for the test to 45, leaving new half-centurions in diagnostic arrears as it was. The catch-up contribution are more straightforward. Workers turning 50 this year can add an extra $6,500 to their 401k account, on top of the standard $20,500. There's a bill in Congress called Secure Act 2.0 that would boost catch-up contributions $10,000 for 60-year-olds. It might even pass. A 401k is an example of a defined contribution fund, which is a polite way of saying work longer or keep an open mind between Palm Beach and Papua New Guinea. I've heard all the good things. I've heard only good things. The money management industry is here to help. Targeted funds, sometimes called life cycle funds, first appeared in 1994, around when I got my first 401k type job. If you remember Ron Popeil's rotisserie chicken infomercials, you know enough about how these funds work. Set it and forget it, as the audience of Popeil used to say in unison. You pick one fund with your tentative retirement date in the name, maybe a targeted 2040 fund in my case. That's it. An investment committee puts the money of best mix of assets for your age and changes percentages as you grow older. I never bought one because I'm cheap, and targeted date funds come with a higher expense than plain index funds. Maybe that's for the best. A new report from Bank of America Securities calculates the performance of the 2040 fund since 1994 and finds that it has trailed the S&P 500 by 2.4 percentage points a year. On its own, that's understandable. A stock and bond mix should provide lower returns than a stock index, but with less risk. But the report finds that the risk profile for the two has been nearly the same. A simple 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds would have provided higher returns than the targeted fund with much lower volatility. There are three main reasons targeted funds have struggled, says Jared Woodard, who heads the Research Investment Committee of Bank of America. They allocate too much money to expatriate markets, ex-U.S. markets, especially Europe and Japan. Investors would be better off picking a few stocks in those markets than buying indexes. What it says, the future also assumes that treasury and high-quality corporate bonds will always be a good hedge against stock downturns. When rates are rising, like now, investors might be better off with some of their money in cash, despite the inflation hit. In an instrument with high credit risk but less interest rate risk, like junk bonds or senior floating rate funds, an emerging market bond. The third reason is that target dated funds stick rigidly to their allocation and rebalancing rules, which is good for novice investors who would otherwise sit in all cash, but maybe not for an experienced investor. I'm not suggesting people try to time the market, says Woodard, but I think in the case of some of these different investment vehicles, there's a bit of a missed opportunity. Part of Woodward's target date critique applies to investing more broadly, and thus to those who don't own those funds. The problem is, I can't tell whether he's right, and we've just reached the moment when U.S. shares are exceptionally cheap and beaten down. Treasuries have non-negligible yields for the first time in recent memory. And I plan to feel less guilty about my home country stock bias at least. The only thing I'm confident about is the size of my 401k contribution this year. I plan to define the heck out of that. Next article is also from Barron's, and it is from the economy and policy section up and down. I'm not certain we'll get through all of it. It's fear of June swoon rattles investors. Is a rebound lurking? And what is so rare as a day in June than if ever comes perfect days? James Russell Lowell's poetic words aptly describe some year's 6 month, but not this one, when seemingly everywhere the mood appears to be dark and grayest weeks of February. The foreboding seems to work in corporate suites. Brace for Hurricane J.P. Morgan Chase. CEO Jamie Dimon warned this past week. Then Tesla's mercurial chief Elon Musk is in an email seen by Reuters confessed to be super bad feeling about the economy, which may have prompted him to call for a 10% staff cut at the electric automaker. That's after 16,800 pink slips were handed out last month by 66 technology companies, the most since May 2020, at the depth of the pandemic. Our colleagues at New York Post, based on data from stacking trackers, layoffs, FYI, many of those cuts come from outfits with much promise but no profits that burn through copious amounts of cash bestowed by a once exuberant equity market. But even companies not dependent on markets for funding, such as J.P. Morgan and Tesla, might feel the effects of stock slumps. The notion was poised by Alan Greenspan decades ago, according to The Man Who Knew Sebastian Malby's biography of the former Federal Reserve chairman. With their shares off 25 and 43% from their respective highs, J.P. Morgan and Tesla honchos, who have big personal stakes in their own stock, understandably might feel less than chipper. Similarly, The bull and bear indicator tracked by Bank of America strategist led by Michael Harnett moved to extreme bearish, its lowest rating since June 2020. During the worst of the pandemic, when a COVID-19 vaccine was still months away. Peter Atwater, an adjunct professor of economics at Williams & Mary's, details in his latest financial insight missive an array of downbeat developments, including the latest cover of The Economist featuring the unpleasant prospect of nuclear war and a U.S. recession. Contrarians naturally infer when things look this bad, they only get better. The Bank of America indicator, which has slashed buy since last March, points to a bounce in the S&P 500 index to 4,400 from Friday's close of 4,108. Atwater also observes that small cap stocks, price earnings, ratios match their nadirs touched in the 2020 pandemic lows and the 2009 bottom following the financial crisis. While many of the previously exalted have been humiliated, notably Cathie Wood, whose ARK Innovations exchange-traded fund has completed a round trip back from March 2020. A reversal of the current despair could be accompanied by an outbreak of peace, prosperity, and the end of COVID-19, and political polarization in America, he says. The bounce envisioned by Bank of America strategists should fade once the S&P hits 4,200, however, and should be sold short if it gets to 4,400. That's because global central banks are just starting to tighten monetary policies. No fun until the Fed is done, which won't be until payroll employment posts a monthly drop, they write. The largest job numbers released on Friday indicates the opposition a stronger-than-expected 399,000 payroll increase for May, tempered only slightly by 22,000 net negative revisions for the two preceding months. The separate survey of households showed the headline unemployment rate at 3.6% for the third consecutive month, a mere tenth above the pandemic lows. The average hourly earnings were up 0.3% for May and up 5.2% from a year earlier. But pay for rank-and-file workers is rising faster, with non-supervisory employees' hourly wages up 0.6% in the last month, while smaller gains for supervision and white-collar workers held down the overall rise. Thomas Simons, a money market economist at Jefferies, points out in his research notes. And I think we're at the end. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Jenna Walker, reading from North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.